All lines are now bridged.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning again to our HITECH members, and Happy New Year to you all. Thank you for members of the public for joining our first meeting of the year here. It's great to see our members in person after quite some time of just being virtual only. Let's see, we have a full agenda to kick off our year today. I realize that the meeting is a bit longer than our past virtual meeting, so we do have a formal brief break right around 12:30 or so. We have some new faces slash names to the committee. Welcome Dr. Stephen Hester and Lisa Fry to the HITECH. Also, as a reminder, especially for our new members, please use the raise hand function in Adobe if you'd like to make a question or a comment. And we had an administrative meeting just before this, so I'm going to document the roll call from earlier. We have Erin Meary, Denise Webb, Michael Adcock, Lisa Fry, Valerie Gray, Jim Jurgis, Cynthia Fisher, John Kinski, Ken Kawamoto, Stephen Lane, Les Leonard, Arian Malik, Clem McDonald, Brett Oliver, Terry O'Malley, James Pentelis, Carolyn Peterson, Raj Watwani, Alexis Snyder, Sasha Termott, Andy Truscott, Cheryl Turney, Robert Waugh, Michelle Schreiber, James Elvey, Ram Shiram, Andy Gundalapi, Jonathan Nebelker. Are there any other members that I have not announced or were not present on the earlier administrative call?
Great. Did you call Abby Sears?
Abby, are you on the line? I didn't catch her earlier. Do we have Abby?
Oh, I see her in the participant list. Maybe she's not on the audio yet.
Okay. We will.
She's saying she's here in the chat box.
Got it. Thank you, Abby. Also from our ONC leadership, we have Dr. Don Rucker, Steve Podnock, Beth Myers, Seth Kavinsky, Dr. Andy Gettinger, and Dr. Tom Mason. Before we turn it over to Dr. Rucker for opening remarks, again, just wanted to take this time to offer any committee member the opportunity to disclose any outside activities with ONC. We'll just ask you to get into the queue by raising your hand, and then we'll jump right into the agenda. Starting with John Kansky.
We have.
Thanks, John Kansky. Just for transparency's sake, acknowledging that I serve on the board of the Sequoia Project, which is the RCE, perhaps not surprisingly, my organization occasionally participates in small contracts with the ONC, right now specifically supporting the national COVID response. Thanks.
Thank you. And Raj?
Good morning. This is Raj Ratwani with MedStar Health. The MedStar Health Research Institute has a contract from the Office of the National Coordinator.
Thank you. Ken?
Good morning. Just in general, I have honoraria consulting, sponsored research licensing or co-development with McKesson, Hitachi, Pfizer, Premier, Clasis, RTI, Mayo, University of Washington, UC San Francisco, MD Aware, and ONC via ESAC and Security Risk Solutions in the last 3 years, and was also an unpaid board member of HL7, and I've helped develop a number of tools which we might commercialize.
Thank you, Ken. And Andy Truscott?
Hi, I'm Andy Truscott. I'm the chair-elect of HL7.
And Stephen Lane.
And I mentioned it in the earlier meeting, but I'll repeat it here for the record that I serve as the chair of the board of the Sequoia Project and chair of the steering committee for care quality, both of which are involved in the ONC's TEFCA RCE work.
Thank you, Carolyn?
Yes, I am an unpaid board member of HL7.
Thank you. And Erin, is that your hand in the queue?
Yes, Aaron Meary. I am an unpaid board member of the Sequoia Project.
Great. Any others? With that, I will turn it over to Dr. Rucker for a few remarks.
All right. Thank you, Lauren. Well, first of all, welcome, everybody, to the new year. I would like to thank Carolyn and Robert for their leadership and their chair service, and welcome. Also like to thank some of the folks who are who've served in the past on High Tech. So Christina Carabello, Emil Jane, Steve Reddy, and Tina Esposito. Welcome Stephen Hester and Lisa Fry on. And finally, would definitely like to welcome Denise and Aaron to their new role as chairs. I've had the chance to have some personal discussions with both of them over the years and various things, and they are both very astute in understanding the complex landscape and, frankly, leading organizations through that landscape, understanding the challenges, the opportunities. So it's really, I think, a great pair of folks as chair. So just want that to be known. This is, as folks know, my last time. I didn't know doing whatever I do on High Tech. I guess leading ONC. With the change in administration, it's been, an extraordinary privilege for me and a pleasure to work with the ONC team and to work with you. I think the ongoing work that you guys have done, some of it we're going to even talk about today in fruition. Obviously, everybody knows the rule. I think it is one of the, well, I hope, go down as one of the pivotal events in getting the American public back into knowledge about and control of their healthcare in a way that is truly empowering, truly modern, and sync with the rest of our digital lives. So I want to thank folks for the work there. While there's a lot of legal considerations in making that possible, the underpinning is all standards, and you guys have done great work on the various standard suggestions and the reports. They're fascinating, at times dry reading, but fascinating. I believe I've read all of them. I guess there'll be somebody else reading them from now on, but I actually hope to read a lot of it as well. As time goes on, you're going to see the U.S. core data for interoperability, which we've just released based on part in your suggestions. I do want to note that the shopping list of suggestions for the U.S. CDI was very, very, very long, both from folks, in the high tech community and then in the public at large. We've had to, sort of really put in, some powerful selection pressures, because this is the data that we are asking essentially every EMR to sort of, steward and collect. And so as things evolve, High Tech will no doubt be there for next steps, but it is heavily bounded by what we want to ask of every single participant in the EHR ecosystem, increasingly globally with our GDHP work on the International Patient Summary, which is the international version of the US CDI. So for folks who didn't get their data field in, just blame it on me. That's the explanation on that. So it's out there, and obviously further consensus. I think as I leave and reflect on things, I think we have in front of High Tech some extraordinary opportunities. Obviously, there's further evolution of standards. I think there's the great work that has been done on integrating clinical and administrative data. I think as we look at things like patient matching and identification, I would encourage folks to think very richly about patient matching as more than just a number, but really the entire package of authenticating patients, you know, the authorizations of what data patients are eligible to see, you know, theirs, family members, and then the consent process. It really needs to be an integrated whole. I'll just close with saying, obviously, we've had an extraordinary public health emergency. I think it has shown and gotten me certainly focused a lot on how we do health information exchange, right? It's something that has been very aspirational in the ONC work, literally since David Brailer and Secretary Leavitt started this back in the day. I think today, as we look around with health information exchanges, especially the state and local ones that are essentially last mile, we have some extraordinary opportunities to get to really expand that in a very pro-competitive way so that all players in healthcare can compete in offering services to patients, and that we can get in, you know, the folks like group homes, shelters, jails, schools, that whole milieu that is part of care, and do that in a robust privacy-protecting way. Hopefully we'll do it efficiently. You know, as you look at the public health emergency, the exigencies of COVID have required a vast burden of out-of-process reporting, spreadsheets, flat files flying around everywhere. There's a disconnect there when we've all invested in EMRs, and pretty much all now through our collective work have EMRs. So I think we really need to work with the HIEs and get that information to our public health authorities, to CMS, to FDA, to all of the public agencies that need data, so that we're not doing this in a duplicate kind of way. There's an extraordinary opportunity here. It is well within the charge of HITECH to rethink the entire nature of reporting of health to government. Again, it's one of many, many opportunities. So I wish all of you well look forward to your continued great work. So with that, let me turn it over to Denise and Aaron to get things going. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Rucker, thank you so much for your leadership. Well, welcome, HITECH. Welcome to a brand new year. It is 2021. Let us hope that 2020 is in the rearview mirror and we're moving forward. I am honored to be one of your co-chairs going forward with my partner, Denise Webb. I did want to say real quick, though, I want to offer first a thanks to Carolyn Peterson and Robert Wall for their phenomenal leadership the prior couple of years. HITECH, being brand new and instituted under 21st Century Cures, we had to sort of figure out the road, and they were phenomenal, phenomenal leaders in helping us in our committee. And so I am honored to help take up the baton moving forward. Second, I want to say thank you, Dr. Rucker, to you, the entire administration, all of HHS, the secretary. You are correct in that COVID was a eye-opening event for a number of things, but your leadership was instrumental, particularly with the HITECH and the ONC, but across all of HHS. And so I'll speak with my provider hat on now. The things and the opportunities that you and HHS helped alleviate, barriers to overcome, hurdles to hop over that we didn't even know were hurdles until they hit us in the face, was instrumental. And I thank you on behalf of the entire provider community. There's a saying here in Texas, find grace in chaos. You helped us find that grace, and I want to thank you for that. So thank you for your leadership. Denise?
All right. And I certainly echo those comments. I really appreciate your comments, Dr. Rucker. And I want to extend my personal thanks to you and to Carolyn and to Robert for your leadership and passion and contributions to our collective work. It has been just awesome, the amount of work that we've gotten done in the last few years. And your leadership has definitely been instrumental in that. And I hope that you will stay involved in possibly different ways as you leave your position. And we are certainly going to miss you. You know, we have a busy agenda today. I need to quickly go over that with you. And we're going to start our day with approval of the minutes. And then Carolyn Peterson and Erin Meary are going to give an update on the HITECH annual report work group. And hopefully many of you got to look at the draft. It looks superb. A lot of good work. We will also get a presentation from Al Taylor in the Office of Technology at ONC, and he's going to tell us about that draft that just came out for the U.S. Core Data for Interoperability version 2. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back, and Alex Muggy from CMS and Stephen Posnack from ONC will talk to us about the CMS interoperability and prior authorization proposed rule. Following that, Bakul Patel from the FDA is going to tell us about the FDA's Digital Health Center. And then finally, Lauren Ritchie will go over the HITECH 2021 final work plan. And of course, we will have public comments after that, which are very important.
Alrighty, so let's get into it then. Next on the agenda here is the approval of the prior minutes. Hopefully you received that in your inbox. I want to take a second to pop that up. And I will look for a motion for approval, please.
This is Cheryl, so moved.
May I have a second, please?
Second.
This is Stephen, I'll second.
All right, all those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay. All right. Meeting agenda is approved and prior minutes are approved. All right. Denise?
All right. So we are going to start off with the update on our HITECH annual report work group, and I'm going to turn it over to Carolyn Peterson and Erin Meary. And if anyone on the committee has questions, please raise your hand and we'll be watching for those questions.
Great. Thanks, Denise. If we could have the next slide, please. I think what you'll see today in our set of slides is somewhat similar to what you have seen in the past. There's a discussion of how we've proceeded as a work group, and we will then get to the discussion about the draft that you were sent. So I will move quickly through the slides so we can get to the discussion. What we have here is our scope. As you all know, we did quite a bit of work this year with regard to considerations around public health and COVID, and the scope of the work group's charge was expanded to include the target area of public health, as well as our three priority target areas laid out in the 21st Century Cures Act. The overarching charge is to inform, contribute to, and review draft and final versions of the HITECH annual report, which will go to HHS and Congress. This report is intended to track our progress as well as to provide recommendations for ONC and the broader community. And looking at what we have in our document this year, we have analysis of HITECH progress related to the target areas, as well as assessment of health IT infrastructure and advancements, analysis of existing gaps in policies and resources, and ideas for potential HITECH activities to address those gaps. Next slide, please. This is our membership. Again, myself, Erin Meary, and Brett Oliver were on the work group this year. Christina Caraballo was also involved through December. She is listed as a former member, and we have our ONC staff led by Michelle Murray and her team helping us with the drafting of this document. Next slide, please. Next slide. Our meeting schedule, as you know, we've pretty much run through the bulk of our work. Today we present the review draft for you. We hope to get your feedback and to present to you next month a final draft that can be approved and sent forward to the National Coordinator and to Congress. Next slide, please. So today we'll be reviewing this report and suggesting edits. Next month, we hope you'll be able to approve a revised draft, and then the HITECH will transmit that final report to the National Coordinator. From there, it will go to HHS and Congress. Next slide, please. So now we'll get into the discussion part of this work. Next slide, please. Our target areas: interoperability, privacy and security, and patient access to information, as stipulated by the 21st Century Cures Act. And we have expanded that to include the use of technologies that support public health. Next slide, please. The outline of our annual report remains the same as it was in previous years. We start with the executive summary, the foreword, and an overview. We review HITECH progress in fiscal year 2020. We have an landscape analysis, a gap analysis, and we provide some recommendations for addressing infrastructure gaps in health IT. We provide suggestions for additional HITECH initiatives, and then there is a conclusion and some appendices of related information that would be helpful as you read the draft and also all the references that are noted. Next slide, please. So our progress in fiscal year 2020, we had 8 meetings of the full HITECH and 1 hearing. We had 45 meetings of 3 HITECH subcommittees. We presented 52 recommendations to the National Coordinator, and these activities focused on priority uses of health IT, the intersection of clinical and administrative data, and the U.S. core data for interoperability, which we'll hear more about today. Next slide, please. With regard to the landscape analysis, we have an annual assessment of the health IT infrastructure, both at the national and local levels, allowing for electronic access, exchange, and use of health information. The intention is to cover key topics in each of the 4 target areas, as well as federal activities across those areas. And we note some additional topics in the landscape analysis for awareness. Next slide, please. Coming to the gap analysis, this is again a requirement under the 21st Century Cure Act. We're looking for gaps in policies and resources for achieving the ONC fiscal year 19-20 objectives and benchmarks, and furthering interoperability throughout the health IT infrastructure. Next slide, please. We have recommendations as well. These are arranged in a tiered approach, some being immediate opportunities that we anticipate could be or should be tackled in the next 1 to 2 years. That would be 2021-22, and then longer-term opportunities, which are things we could look at, but probably are something that may occur 3 or more years out. Next slide, please. So now we're coming to the discussion. We really want to focus on 3 particular questions for the group today. First, do you have any questions or comments that we need to answer to help you better understand the draft report? Second, any suggested revisions that you have to the draft? And finally, do you have any ideas for the parking lot list for a future annual report? In some years, we have had ideas for discussion points that came up that are not things we anticipated would be ready to tackle immediately, but that we don't want to lose sight of. And so we put those in a list that we can consult in future years as we put the report together, to see if we are ready or in need of going forward with those. With that, Erin and I are ready for discussion.
All right. Thank you, Carolyn. We do have a question from Cheryl Turney.
Thank you.
Go ahead,
Denise.
Cheryl.
Thank you, Denise. Under immediate opportunities, one of the things that I was looking at regarding both public health reporting and vaccine tracking is today the immunity registries are not really set up for data consumption. They're set up for, you know, reporting to some federal group regarding the vaccine use. And as payers have been looking to provide vaccine monitoring for return to work and other types of activities, you know, one of the things that we've identified is that there needs to be some sort of support to allow, sorry, I'm losing my voice, the consumption of data. And I know some of them are implementing Snowflake, but I do think we need to have some greater recommendation or more robust recommendation regarding data consumption and interoperability for that data, especially as we're, you know, currently trying to figure out how to reopen everything, you know, with the pandemic.
That's a really good point. Maybe we can also open up, if we don't mind, Excel team, the actual document itself and just go to the chart. That may be helpful, the executive summary chart, so we can actually pull up that area and point to it as folks talk about. There we go. Perfect.
Yeah. The one I had was page 5.
5, thank you. Yep, so I figured. So that last one, vaccine tracking. There we go. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yes, thank you.
Yep, perfect. All right, perfect. Okay, so something robust is about ingestion of the data, essentially, and normalization, I would think, and standardization. Is that where you're going with it?
Yes, exactly. And, I mean, there are apps trying to work on this right now, and the biggest issue is, you know, how do you streamline the interoperability? Really the easiest way to get the data would be to get it directly from the provider, of course, but we don't have that full structure set up. So the next best approach is to use some sort of consumption of the data that's currently reported to the registries, which also are not consistent across the country, we've already discovered. But none of them are set up for any type of consumption activity. Some of them have rudimentary data exchanges for HEDIS and STARS reporting, but typically only on an annual basis. So A, they don't have the staff, and B, they don't have the technical setup. But, you know, in the discovery that, you know, we've been working on, there definitely are some that are working on Snowflake. I don't know if that's a, you know, and I don't know if it's up for us to discover, but there is some activity going on that way. But whatever recommendations we can put in to help beef up that data exchange, I think is going to be really important to coming out of this pandemic and having that data available to us and the third-party apps who need it for a returning to work and returning to life.
Mm-hmm. Great points. Great points. Okay. We can definitely take that.
Thank you, Cheryl. Arian Malik is next in the queue.
Yep, thank you. And just on that point, one of the things that I've been noting in recent comments in this area is the need to have an incentive structure and funding structure that aligns incentives. One of the systematic issues that we're in right now is a result of an EHR incentive program without a corresponding public health incentive program and public health funding model. So, you know, I would recommend that the report, particularly since it's a report back to Congress, focus on the funding mechanisms and the associated interoperability requirements attached to those funding mechanisms that help us create an ecosystem-based approach rather than a sort of a forced mandate-based approach. So, you know, as an example, we had an EHR incentive program that included immunization, included bi-directional immunization registry components, but we didn't have a corresponding funding model for public health immunization information systems or a set of certification requirements for those systems that were matched to the level of funding. So as we go forward, I think it's really important if we want something to happen as an ecosystem, as a nation, that we have a focused set of incentives, associated funding that are then matched with certification requirements and certification programs that make sure that we, and testing programs that make sure that we have a full end-to-end system. As many people have noted, when we deployed immunization registry or deployed reportable labs on the ground, many people discovered that the EHR output didn't match the public health input, and a more careful approach to incentives and incentive matching would help us address those situations. Thank you.
Thanks, Arian.
All right. Wes Leonard?
Yeah, I've got a couple comments on, you know, the idea of the data not being accessible at all, I think is overstated. We've got the CDC has two sets of data.
I yield my time to the gentleman from Indiana.
Yeah, I was just going to say that doesn't sound like Les.
I thought you said Clem. Never mind. Sorry.
Oh. Les, go ahead.
Please go ahead,
and then we'll get to you, Clem.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, I'm going to go ahead. All right. I think that for us not to call for a national patient identifier or a systematic schema for national identification based on state or regional identifiers as more consistent with the law. But whatever it is, we need to definitively identify patients to track vaccines. And yep. That without that, we're wasting our time. Second,
so scroll down. Les, if you didn't read, so can you scroll down Excel, the one item? So that's literally the next bullet on here. It's exactly for that. Well, we can specifically call out vaccination if you would like, but we did talk about patient matching and public identification.
Yeah, but I mean, how can we track who has been vaccinated in a diffuse ecosystem wherever people are going to go to stadiums or everywhere to get vaccinated and conduct population health programs to target the most vulnerable without an identifier that spans health systems? We're just not going to be able to do it. So
agreed.
We are urgent point right now. We need to develop an urgent, emergent, really reaction to this. Enough time has passed, and that if there is a use case for a national identifier, there could not be a possibly stronger one than trying to vaccinate the nation, especially with a vaccine that requires two doses delivered 3 weeks apart. That in a nation with a fractured health system and with people who are underserved and at higher risk because of their lack of resources, we could not have a stronger call for a national. If you cannot come up with a single number, let's come up with a strategy to use state identifiers or some other approach. Second, you know, this call for public health to be part of an ecosystem of that Arian just said is the most important thing. Public health has been designed as part of their data systems have been part of what's been called an information supply chain. They have focused on that for really generations of public health providers have been trained in this theory that all data flows upward for policy decision making for public health. And now we are in a situation where public health does have some of the data flowing upward through vaccine information systems, through IIS, which are among the best standardized public health systems and well supported by meaningful use to deliver HL7V2X messages at a state level and pass those on to CDC. But public health, all those registries often have capabilities for individual level reporting on vaccines without an identifier. But, you know, you can know the three Mrs. Smiths that have received their vaccine who are all born on this day. The problem is there is no infrastructure for public health for population reporting. That is to say, the flat fire type of infrastructure we're going to talk about with CMS later in the morning. There is no way for public health registries to respond to a list of patients from a population health provider to be able to deliver their vaccine status. That is a significant lapse in our infrastructure that has to be urgently addressed right now, so that the people who are trying to target the most vulnerable can regularly get an update from the only, these hierarchical public health systems that we have to do their work. Because this won't be done by public health. This has to be done by the providers of population health care, which are payers, and the healthcare delivery systems that are taking care of people. So two-way interoperability, it is possible with our technologies now to do this, but we have to get off our bums and get on with the work with this. And that we are in an urgent situation, and we need to create the capability to respond at a population level.
Les, you're spot on, and I appreciate your comments. We got to get off our bums. I agree, completely agree with all of that, particularly given you have states like California empowering now dentist offices and others to be able to vaccinate that typically do not have an EHR that conforms easily with state reporting mandates and whatnot. So to the degree of it, you're exactly right. Let's see where we can articulate that and stress the urgency to get off our bums throughout the report. So I think it's well-taken comment.
All right, Clem McDonald, you're up now.
Okay. Well, I'd first like to support everything Les said, but I'd also like to think, the interaction between public health and clinical data has got problems on both sides. I mean, public health has historically been divided by disease or by infection. You know, there's not the unity that could be better, and they sometimes dumb down things in their reporting requirements. And why can't they just aggregate it up if they, rather than dumbing it down, asking the sender to dumb it down? So there's a couple of things both sides need to do better, I think. But there's a couple little dumb things. So we have been getting data from CDC. We have for a project we're working on, in terms of the most who should get vaccinated next, and it's the old guys. It's the old black guys actually. But it turns out 45% of the race codes from the CDC site to surveillance don't have race codes. And that's a combination of cultural things where people don't want to ask because they think it's racist. It's just a complicated beast. Now, the third thing is that the other thing that maybe complicates things is the scorched earth privacy strategies, which makes it really hard to know who the person is and connecting up. And I don't know how we're going to grapple with that, but somewhere along the line, central areas need to know the individuals for certain of these purposes, and it's not always allowed. So those are my comments.
Thanks, Clem.
All right, and it looks like the last person with their hand up is John Kansky at this moment.
Thanks, Denise. So the report looks comprehensive and wonderful, as usual. I want to acknowledge that. With regard to the section on uses of technologies that support public health, I appreciate the acknowledgement that I think echoes some of Dr. Rucker's comments at the beginning of the potential role for health information exchange been demonstrated through the pandemic response. I'm going to suggest that I can save a few words by, at the end of my comment, promising to send to the annual report team a short white paper that I co-authored with David Horax from CRISP. My comment is that there's an emerging model of health information exchange that is suggested that implies, I don't know if it's so much a policy gap as a policy opportunity, because certainly policy could be used to accelerate the nation towards this model, but it basically gives health information exchanges a more official designation at their state level and a responsibility for supporting public health while still entertaining free market competition. So I'll, for what it's worth, I'll share that short white paper in the hopes that it might be helpful.
Thank you.
We'll look for that.
All right. Is there anyone that's just on the phone and not able to raise their hand that has a question? No? Okay, that looks like that. Oh, Stephen Lane has popped up with a question.
Thanks.
Go ahead,
thanks,
Stephen.
Denise. Thank you. I simply wanted to say that I see that we have documentation of the increased health equity across populations as a longer-term opportunity. And I think that within our industry, this has really bubbled up, especially in the context of the pandemic, as a high priority. And I suspect it's also going to be a high priority for the new administration. They've assigned some specific resources to focus on this. So I think we may want to consider moving this up in the priority list as we go through the year.
Okay, noted. I could definitely look at that.
Okay.
One thing I do want to call attention to the high tech is something that we did add net new for this year. We did try to synthesize each target area into a real life scenario or story. So even if you look at, I don't know, page 55, if you don't mind, Excel team, just to show them an example of one, it tries to illustrate in simple English and stories. Go to the bottom of the page, please. You know, what, there you go, an illustrative story. So each of the sections has an illustrative story to talk through that. I do want to ask High Tech to take a look at these. Each area has something like this. We try to pull experiences, comments from this High Tech, last year's report, feedback we've gotten from the community and the public to generate these. And each of them, like I said, has something as to what this could mean if we were able to solve these challenges. Because it is getting complicated to explain. It is getting complicated because there's so many moving parts, particularly given the pandemic that have been uncovered that must be addressed, like unique patient identifier and others. So to that, I would ask High Tech to please take a magnifying glass to the report. Please let us know your comments, your feedback, if these things resonate. We're trying to make this in a way that's digestible and meaningful to the community. Carolyn, anything you want to add to that?
Nope, I just want to reiterate my support for your comment, Aaron, about members of the High Tech sending us your feedback. We do see it as a group product, although a few of us work on it most intensively, and we are interested in being sure that it represents the thinking of the full High Tech.
Aaron and Carolyn, do you have a specific date by which you would like everyone to finish their review and get comments? Do you?
There was a date in one of the emails that was sent out with the documents. I am looking for it right now.
Okay. Just as a reminder for everybody, I recalled seeing it, but I didn't remember what it was.
Yeah. Michelle, do you know off the top of your head? Michelle Murray?
I believe it was Friday the 22nd.
That sounds right.
Yeah, and that would give people a bit more than a week, which would be reasonable.
Okay. Everybody needs to mark their calendars and get their input in if
right.
They haven't had an opportunity yet. All right. Well, it looks like that concludes any questions we have. And thank you very much, Aaron and Carolyn. You guys have done a tremendous amount of work, and we really appreciate it.
And, well, I'm almost remiss to say thank you to the ONC team and the Excel team and to Michelle and to Elise and to everybody that is helping. They translate our long-winded monologues and soliloquies into actionable words and readable words, so we can't do this without them, so thank you.
Yes.
That holds true for all of our subcommittees and all of our work. We could not do it without ONC and our Excel team. Thank you. Okay, with that, I think we're ready to move to the next presentation from Al Taylor on the draft of version 2 of the US CDI.
Hi, good morning. Finally, I got everything. I think I got everything working. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present on the draft USCD version, USCDI version 2. Next slide, please. So here's where we're at in the process. This is a familiar timeline, I think, to everybody. And we are right at the juncture of the new year. We've completed our prep and publication of the draft USCDI version 2, and we have now published it for open comment, for public comment and high-tech comment as well. And we were fortunate enough to be able to get this published for the high-tech to begin consideration. Next slide, please. I think Dr. Recker mentioned earlier that the list of data element submissions through the OnDeck system was really overwhelming, not entirely unpredicted or unpredictable, but we did get a significant, we were really overwhelmed and with over 600 submissions that were put in through the system, more than 60 separate unique submitters from about the same number of organizations submitted data elements for our consideration. Using the rubric and scoring and the evaluation process that we have publicized, we determined that over 100 of these data elements were considered to be level 2, which means most mature, either most ready or actually most in use, and affected a broader group of stakeholders in health IT and healthcare. There were, the same number, a similar number of level 1 and comment levels, which means less mature or less broadly applicable. I think it's interesting to note that almost half of the data elements were submitted were duplicate submissions, which either means that they were identical submissions submitted by multiple submitters, or there were submissions that really constituted a subset of other submissions or other existing data elements. So it just is a tribute to how intense the involvement was across the whole breadth of the stakeholder community. As we published yesterday, next slide, please. As we published yesterday, this is an overall view of the draft USCDI version 2 that we put out for public comment. It's a fairly modest change. It's not a big dramatic change. And also, as Dr. Recker pointed out, this was intentional because people are busy doing a lot of stuff, including responding to the pandemic. So what we have here is we have 9 new data elements, and we actually reorganized several existing data elements into other data classes, and I'll talk about that in a second. We also have 2 new data classes, diagnostic imaging and encounter information. So these are the new data elements that we have added to the draft V2, and we are looking forward to getting probably vigorous feedback from the public on these decisions, the decisions we made and the new decisions we didn't make, and looking forward to working towards a final version later this year. Next slide. Just to drill down into the new data elements and the new data classes. We added 2 provider details or provider data elements out of about 7 different provider data elements, these being what we consider to be the minimum set to identify a provider involved with the care. Diagnostic imaging is obviously a new data class, represents one of the bigger gaps in the concepts of USCDI version 1, and we added the new imaging order or the test requested and the imaging report, which could be structured and unstructured combination. Encounter information is also a new data class with several, but not all of the submitted data elements were added to V2 with encounter type, diagnosis, and time or timing. To the problem data class, we added 2 data elements, including that define the timing related to problem concepts including data diagnosis and resolution. Next slide. One of the key areas of feedback we got when we were deliberating on creating the actually feedback on USCDI version one was the issues around clinical notes and how the data elements within clinical notes or the note types posed a little bit of a problem. And the diagnostic imaging lab report and the path report narratives really were components of the larger, more complete reports for imaging lab and path. And as a result of that feedback, in order to maintain the context of the content of these narrative segments, we reorganized them or reclassified them into their respective data classes. So diagnostic imaging now has a narrative component as a separate data element, and lab and path narratives are the narrative aspects of the lab reports. Next slide. In addition to the new data classes and new data elements and reorganized data elements, we have proceeded to update the existing versions of the terminology code sets that comprise the applicable standards within USCDI version one. We've updated them to the most current version, and it would be our intent, pending feedback from the public and from the HITACH, that the versions should be updated as of the most current at the time. So it would be our intent, if as long as that seems acceptable, to have the most recent versions as of when we publish the data, the final USCDI version 2 in July. But these are the most current versions as of today, well, yesterday. Next slide, please. I meant to have this after the list of numbers of submissions. As the USCDI task force in 2019 predicted, we got way more data elements submitted, and actually way more data elements that ended up as level two than we could even conceivably imagine to add to the versions, the USCDI version two. And so we had to implement a prioritization system in order to select the level two data element that did make it into the USCDI version two. One of the elements of that prioritization, including what I think of as major concept gaps in the USCDI version one. As a clinician, I felt like the diagnostic imaging was one of the biggest gaps, looking at the USCDI version one at from a high level, and diagnostic imaging was one of the data classes that we added. Provider and encounter information also were major gaps, in my opinion, and so they ended up. But that doesn't mean that those are the only significant gaps. There are other gaps that did not make it, and we had to be very selective for a couple of different reasons. Including the burden of updating and implementing these changes as a result of the pandemic and other issues that are going on. Part of our prioritization was to represent a modest technical standards development lift, such as updating the U.S. Core IG or the CCDA IGs. Those technical standards, we heard back from them after we published version one, that they actually struggled for some time. A lot of work went into accommodating the data elements that we added in version one, and it took them over a year and a half to adequately address those new data elements sufficiently for the new data for USCDI version one. And so we deliberately looked for data elements that had already had substantial technical development in these standards, which are necessary to actually implement them. The FHIR and the CCDA implementations of USCDI are those implementation guides. And again, as Dr. Rucker mentioned, we intended to have the vendor development community, as well as the implementation and the provider community, to have not that much additional effort to implement them, And the reason was twofold. One is that they're overwhelmed with the work that they're already doing, but also because we're going to be publishing versions approximately every year, we wanted to encourage incremental updates as opposed to waiting until the next proposed rule where instead of 10 new data elements, we had to, a vendor or an implementer had to adopt, say, maybe 40 or 50 or 100 or something like that. So we were mindful of that. And so we offered this as a small step towards improving interoperability and health data exchange. Next slide, please. So now what? So we've got it published. We have it published for public comment. And over the next several months, up until April 15th, we expect to get some fairly robust public feedback as well as input from the HITECH. Once the public comment is complete, we'll process that like we did after all of the submissions were in October of last year. We'll prepare the final version of USCDI version 2 on or about the 1st of July of this year. Once it becomes a new standard, standard version, it will be considered for the standards version advancement process that we outlined last year. And we also published the first version, the approved updated standards for 2020, which was published this week. And then one of the strong recommendations from HITECH and the USCDI Task Force, when they completed their recommendations, was the HITECH wanted to have a say, and we encouraged that into how do we improve the process. How do we improve the USCDI itself, but how do we improve the process, the submission system, the evaluation system, the decision making and prioritization around selecting new data elements for the next version, and those are the things that we intend to undertake this year, this year and also years in years in the future. Next step, please. Next slide, please. Sorry about that. So we have the charge for the USCDI Task Force and the HITECH as a whole. Overall, these are similar to the charges that we had for the task force in the past in 2019. Overall, we want review and feedback on the entire process and the entire content of draft USCDI version 2 development. The three specific charges are to evaluate what we put out as draft V2 and the appropriateness of it and any changes that the HITECH believes ought to be made. Additions, subtractions, changes are all on the table. And that specifically includes the USCDI version 1 data elements. So all of the data elements in USCDI got added to the draft USCDI version 2. And we added a small amount of data classes and elements for version 2 based on the level 2 data elements that were submitted. So that combination of things. So we're looking for specifically input on the version 1 data elements that were brought forward, as well as the new data elements that were added. We also are looking for feedback on the level 2 data elements that we consider as part of the list of 109 data classes and data elements that were added, and whether or not there's a belief that we should have added some of those level 2 data elements into the draft version 2. And then we look at the process evaluation. So the overall USCDI process, how we put together the submission system, how the submission system works, information that's provided to assist submitters to put in these submissions. We published some evaluation criteria ahead of time to give the submitters more information about how to create a better submission, one that's more of a significant consideration. And we look forward to feedback on that. We also discussed the prioritization process, a recommendation from the HITECH, and and one that we carried out in order to winnow down the field of level two data elements for addition. So the prioritization process with the specific criteria that I outlined before is one of the things that we're looking for. And recognizing that the priorities that we set for that process to be selected on a level two data elements for addition, those prioritizations might change from year to year depending on the overall environment in which we're doing the update for version 3. And so recommendations on those specific priority criteria for the USCDI version 3 submission cycle. This is not intended specifically to force submitters into what they're submitting. So the intent is not to have them not submit certain things that are outside of these priority areas. But it's particularly important for OMC to see those priority areas and to help shape our decisions about which of those new data elements that were submitted for version 3 and level 2 data elements version 2 to possibly be also reconsidered for addition to the next version. Next slide. And that's, can you back up, please back up one slide. So the timelines, these are notional. The first one is less notional, and it's more of a critical timeline. The April 15th is the cutoff for public comment. And we felt like it would be appropriate to have the HITECH also meet that deadline in order to give ONC ample opportunity to process all of the recommendations, not just from the HITECH, but from the public, and to have all of those recommendations inform our decisions about what do we put out in our final USCDI version 2. And the other two are towards the end of the year, towards the end of the version 3 submission process, so that we can make sure that we have it refined so that in the high season of submissions, which will be August, September, possibly early October, when most of the submissions come in anyhow, to have those, have that expansion process, the submission system tuned up, and the evaluation criteria put out to the public so they know what they're getting into when they make a submission. And we are asking for that those tasks to be completed by the end of that version 3 submission process in September. And that's all I have, but I opened up for questions.
Perfect. Dr. Taylor, thank you very much for that presentation. And I do want to open it up to the floor for folks to ask questions. I would say also for folks on the phone, if you're not dialed in, to be able to raise your hand, please state your name. But we're going to go with folks raising their hand first. Let's see here. So I'm now scrolling down to see. All right, so let's just start at the very top here. So Ken Kalamoto, please.
Great. Thank you very much. My question is, it certainly does seem like there's a lot of level two items that have been submitted, and so there's a whole bunch in terms of already pretty well established data elements to consider including to USCDI. Could you comment a little bit on the bandwidth available, or I guess resourcing, not just to identify things that look great and just make putting final touches, if you will, before getting it into USCDI versus things that are really important but might not be already being well exchanged. You might think of areas that are particularly important related to COVID, let's say, or related to, say, social determinants of health, what have you. Maybe it's related to workflows needed for prior authorization. Could you comment a little bit on sort of it seems like the default approach is, you know, if it's almost ready, we're going to take the easiest to push off the, you know, the end and get it into USCDI, which seems completely appropriate in the COVID era. But what about, you know, things that require more than a little bit of a nudge? How do we go there? Thank you.
Are you, Ken, are you referring to bandwidth on ONC's part or bandwidth on the community's part?
I'm thinking ONC, whether it's on moving it through the process or supporting it through pilot projects, et cetera, because from the beginning in USCDI, the task force had identified it's a kind of a chicken and the egg issue where, you know, the things that are most likely to make it are things that the industry is already doing and implementing widely and sharing widely, at which point it's sort of like, well, it's just rubber stamping what's already happening. And, you know, that there is an important role for that, but there's also an important role we thought in that that task force of, you know, what are the things that are important and not being done that needs investment and resources and coordination, and how do we move those forward?
For the most part, Ken, ONC is turning towards the community to provide the drive and the work that needs to be done in order to mature the standards, including not just the terminology standards, but also getting those standards, those concepts into the exchange standards like US Core. Or CCDA. And one of the things that ONC is committed to is to making sure it's very clear about where some of these submissions that might not have made it into USCDI, the draft next version, make it clear to everybody and provide a place to go to organize around some of these data elements that need additional work. There's some possible circumstances in which ONC would sort of sponsor development of it, or whether it's through support of the through our HL7 cooperative agreement, where we do work on development, some sorts of developments of the U.S. Core IG, as well as other implementation guides as well. And so I would say that so there are those possibilities, but for the most part, ONC is turning towards the community to drive the maturity.
Okay. Well, thanks. I think this will probably be an ongoing topic of discussion in the USCDI task force, because again, it is a chicken and egg kind of thing. And we could, I think I've said enough about it, but I think thanks. It's been a recurring. Thanks.
Perfect. Thank you. Next, we have Michelle Schreiber.
Hi, thank you. This is Paul Schreiber. I'm from CMS. And in a way, I'm echoing really what Ken said, but with a little bit of a twist. So CMS had also submitted some data elements to USCDI that are used in our quality measures. And as CMS is trying to move towards all digital measures, you know, having these standardized elements is really very important. The lessons from quality measures in the country over the last decade or so are such that when we don't have agreed upon standards, we get a bunch of one-offs, we get proprietary measures that people then have to pay for. And I'm concerned that we're starting to see that in data elements now. So we've been approached about, for example, clinical oncology elements that we know that there's a group working on. And we approached another group to say, can we standardize around this? And they're like, no, we're working on something entirely different. And our vendor has something else, and we have to pay for it. And I'm talking about big organizations here. And I'm very concerned that if there's not a capacity to kind of expand USCDI relatively easily, that we're going to fall into sort of what happened with quality measures, a bunch of one-offs, organization, proprietary elements that people are going to have to pay for that will create more one-offs, and it will be really very problematic. So I guess my underlying question is, what's the rate-limiting step of how we can get more standardization and more elements into the CDI? What will it take so that we can avoid kind of the sort of problem?
Thanks, Michelle. I agree that the issue about consensus standardization of data elements, and two areas that I recognize that being an issue is in research that has a lot of different ways of representing data, all of which is important for research or for that particular research effort, and cancer as well. There are a lot of different data data elements, data systems, standards around how to represent cancer data. Those two are jump out at me as I look at that, having worked in those two areas over the years. ONC is not going to set the is not going to be the entity that tells the world that you guys all need to agree on one particular system, either the one that we pick or the one that we pick. That's going to be up to the community, recognizing that there's a limitation in the ability to use those standards in EHRs, specifically because of those difficulties developing consensus standards. So if the recognizing that because research has 4, 6, 8 different data sets or data standards, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult to get those into the standard system, which is these part of being part of USCDI means that all EHRs who update to the new version of the standard, all EHRs have to be able to have the capability of capturing this, which means that it should serve a broader stakeholder community, not just the communities that specifically want these new data elements to be added to USCDI. So it's that issue about whoever's using that data has to agree that there's one way of representing the data, and that one way can go can be added, could at least be proposed to be added to USCDI.
Good deal. Dr. Taylor, thank you for that. All right, so next on the list here, we've got Clem.
Oh, thank you. So I liked all those comments, and especially the one from Michelle. And I just like to, the federal government pays for some of these things that then get turned around into something that people have to pay for. You know, it's tricky because some of these things need support, but I think we should just say no to federally mandated coding systems that you have to pay for. It's just a burden. Just the management of it is a burden. And the CMS has done a little bit of that, you know, with ICD. So I hope they could get brave and push a little bit harder, but I understand it's tough. But I wanted to, I want to first, again, kind of praise Don Rucker, because in my, 40 years of working in standards, he's been the grease on the standards development process like I've never seen before. And I mean, it just is happening now. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Whereas, you know, we just trudge along, go an inch forward and a half inch back until that. So that said, getting back to the use SCDI, I can't figure out for sure what it's saying. So I looked at the draft thing, and the draft thing, some of its statements, some of its comments through ISA. So it would be nice, and maybe if I'm going to get to that. I just saw how you get to that other tab, and I might be able to get a better handle on it. But, you know, some of the earlier ones just said you do this and do this, and it's not quite as clear. Like, I don't know, are units required at all? It's not clear. It should be, you know, if you're going to compute on them. But anyway, those are aside. It'll all come out, I'm sure, so I won't worry about too much about that. So thank you.
Thanks,
all right.
Thanks, Clem.
All right. So let's go on next then to Arian.
All right. Thank you. So first of all, I think Clem means CPT rather than ICD. ICD is a WHO standard, and CPT is a proprietary standard that requires additional purchase. I want to double down on Michelle's comments on aligning USCDI to the uses for which interoperable data is required. And, you know, if we can't pull data out of EHR systems and automatically adjudicate clinical quality measures, or if we can't pull data out of EHRs and automatically adjudicate, for example, disability determination with SSA, then, you know, I think we really need to question the role of USCDI. And to some extent, that cuts both ways. If SSA is looking for areas for disability determination that are not routinely collected in EHRs, or if clinical quality measures are looking for information that aren't routinely collected in EHRs. We've got an ecosystem problem, and I'll just be a kind of a pain and just keep pointing out this ecosystem that if we don't think about suppliers and consumers and make sure that we have the interoperability requirements and the data collection requirements matched up against the uses like clinical quality measures or immunization information registries or SSA disability determination or natural history real-world evidence trials like recovery, then we're really doing ourselves a disservice as a nation. So I just really appreciate the alignment that's required between USCDI and the uses to which interoperable data are put.
All right. Thank you, Arian. All right. Next on the list is Mr. Steve Posnack.
Hey, thanks very much. I'd come
Go
on
easy,
video,
Army.
But I, what's that?
Go easy, Army.
No, I for some reason I can't get on video. Otherwise, I'd do that. Perhaps at the break, I'll get my Adobe Connect back online. So I just wanted to pick up on Ken's points and Michelle's, as well as some of the items in the chat. So for everyone's benefit, we released it the other day three different documents. So one was the draft USCDI version 2. That includes, you know, everything that Al just covered and what can be made available for everyone to comment on, both the public as well as the high-tech process. We also included the standards version advancement process decisions for 2020. That's an end of calendar year type of thing. So those are final. And then to give you all credit and to show you that we do listen and implement your recommendations, there's something called the standards bulletin that we also published, which is going to be periodically published during the years going forward to help cumulatively bind together a number of different, you know, ONC standards initiatives to give people that context and information. So when it comes to the additional details, some of which Al covered in his slides today, that's now included in the standards bulletin with, you know, helpful links and other directions for people to go in. But the point that Ken and Michelle and others have started to poke at a bit is I think, you know, and was recognized by the earlier USCDI task forces, is going to be a tension and a balance that we're going to face perpetually. That is why we tried to lay out that there are other opportunities for groups to continue to work together in a community-based way, but also recognition that at some point policy prioritization will need to be put in place. And if there is a need to promote and get industry response associated with supporting certain data elements, then we may need to use the USCDI process to do that as well. And so it's going to be a both and is my answer. The unique device identifier for implantable devices is probably a good example of that. In 2015, we included that as part of the common clinical data set, you know, the precursor to USCDI. There was unclear adoption in industry, but we knew from a policy perspective and from a data element support perspective that we wanted all EHR technology to support that data element. And, you know, that would be a good example where we kind of put forward a prospective requirement that the industry needed to catch up to. And so there's always going to be this balance where we could adopt any data element that we want, you know, and include it in the USCDI, but there may not necessarily be the technical specifications fully spec'd out, fully tested in industry, and that will have to catch up in cycles after the policy decision is made. So we're going to wrestle with this decision, I think, every year, and it's always going to be a balance, and that's why we've tried to implement a predictable timeline for everybody to know when their participation is going to be most valuable. Be as transparent as possible about all the data elements that are accessible via the OnDeck system. And, you know, that will be a continued dialogue that we will enjoy having with everybody, because I think these are the types of conversations that we really want to have now when we look at, you know, what data elements we want to be broadly accessible, both for document exchange as well as for API-based exchange. As you all well know from our regulatory briefing, the USCDI comes to life through the certification criteria that we have both for CCDA document exchange as well as the, you know, secure standards-based API for FHIR that we've adopted as well. So those are the two places where the impact happens. Again, we recognize that there will be times from a policy prioritization perspective that we'll have to be forward-leaning with certain selections for the USCDI. And that'll change, you know, from year to year based on what's available and where we need to go.
Perfect, Steve. Thank you very, very much. So I know that Jonathan Nebaker is trying to ask a question, but I believe he's having audio problems. So Ken, I think you're subbing in, tag teaming in WWE style to help Jonathan out, ask the question.
Sure. He just typed in an updated question. He says, I don't see any rationale in the doc on ONC site. I modify my question. How and when can we have access to the rationale for decision-making?
Yeah, so this is Steve again. Just to answer, I was about to type in the chat. You know, Jonathan, we provided the priorities that we used as our principles for selecting the data elements. There's a slide back, I think that Al used to describe that. That is our rationale. We are not able to provide a data element by data element rationale. We looked at the whole. We looked at areas where there were significant gaps, impact from our perspective. That would enrich the USCDI going forward. And as Al mentioned, the various context dimensions that we had to keep in mind this year, given its inaugural cycle, that is the dynamic of our rationale.
All right. There's a thanks from Jonathan. Perfect. That answered my question. Did they answer it? Great. Thank you, Steve, for doing that. All right. Next on the list here is Mr. Les Leonard.
Second to come off mute. Thank you. I think this is a very opportune time, and I know the USCDI is a big ship and difficult to turn, but the question that has to be put forward and has already been raised by Ken and others is USCDI 1 adequate for our job fighting this pandemic in terms of understanding what vaccines have been administered, first versus second dose different lots or other, the safety issues that might come up with that. So to make sure that the present USCDI is there for just the data that are available. And is it adequate for assessing the quality of vaccination delivery services? Can we develop metrics based on the USCDI? Again, leveraging off of some of the other remarks that Aaron has made or others have made about computable quality measures, does the USCDI support computable quality measures on the efficiency of vaccine administration? In a world where there are changing denominators and a need to to target resources to the most at risk, and to be able to judge the efficiency of providers, not just at passing out vaccines to healthy people, but to actually target those who are in greatest need for vaccination.
Thanks, Les. The short answer is USCDI is not adequate to for the amount of information that it could be captured and exchanged with USCDI. Just USCDI is not adequate. It's not adequate to capture all data elements for any even generic clinical quality measurement or any other program measurement. But it's not intended to be. It's not intended to solve every problem. But what it is, in general, it's a core. That's why it's called core. It's not everything. Just like the exchange standards are not, are more of an 80% solution rather than 100% solution. The USCDI, because of the amount of time it takes to develop it, update it, and then implement it, whether it's voluntary implementation or required implementation, makes USCDI a little bit, the big ship analogy is a great one. It's probably not going to be responsive to things like pandemics, which, God willing, will be completely over by the time we implement version 2. There are other mechanisms both within ONC and without ONC that can better address those. The Interoperability Standards Advisory is a very flexible, potentially very fast-moving resource as a guide compendium for standards and processes that can be used to respond to any number of different contingencies, including a pandemic response. Other program requirements that can be implemented more quickly through the CDC or the FDA or through CMS
can better define what those requirements are for health IT and allow for adoption or adaptation through other mechanisms besides USCDI. So I agree with you that it's not in and of itself adequate to respond to such things like this pandemic.
D2 should move a step closer to that, otherwise we risk irrelevance. Second, people have been seeing this pandemic coming for 25 years. The idea that we would have a respiratory pandemic of a highly infectious disease is not a novel idea that we just discovered in 2020. We're going to have this going forward. So I think that the important thing is to learn the lessons. I think the greatest challenge is that if we consider work on standards that would be viewed as irrelevant in the present crisis.
Sounds good. All right. Next on the list, we have Jim Juris. Jim Jurgis.
Hey there. Hey, a quick question. I noticed with the proposed HIPAA rules that there's sort of a relaxation of this minimally necessary issue, for privacy reasons. Only sharing the minimally necessary for the ask is often very important in protecting patients' privacy, security, et cetera. As we expand the USCDI, more and more risk of unnecessary noise at the very best or unnecessary sharing could arise. And do we believe that by virtue that it's a RESTful API with USCDI 4, that the market will simply begin restricting the ask to some subcomponents of the full USCDI that then is under information blocking protection? Or do we believe that we should address the issue of oversharing, particularly as we add data elements over time?
So I think that not being a lawyer, not being a renowned expert on HIPAA, the capabilities, the USCDI defines what the capabilities of collection and exchange are, not the actual payload for a particular use for a particular exchange, and the content of a particular exchange is going to fall into that minimum necessary. So if the minimum necessary is my entire record, then that's the minimum necessary. If I ask for my entire blue button download, if the blue button download is comprised of entirely USCDI data elements, then that's the minimum necessary. But if the minimum necessary is my last lab report, then even though that's a component of my USCDI.
Yeah, I view it less as an issue when a patient's asking is, for example, a payer, for example, might ask for information to justify an encounter, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a finite set of data elements. See our prior auth piece we're about to talk, right? If in the USCDI that becomes a, hey, I had a head cold, but please share us the entire USCDI, that seems to be incongruent with what we're trying to do with minimally necessary. Or yeah, a particular... getting the urologic vasectomy data, or I'm just curious if it's less for the patient than with other workflows.
Yeah, it's not. So the USCDI doesn't define what has to be in the response. It defines what could be in the response. And the response would have to be an appropriate response. It has to be an appropriate request, minimum necessary request, and then the response would have to be a minimum necessary response.
Thank you.
All right. So next on the list here, we have Ms. Ken. Mr. Ken.
Great. Thanks. I think I really like Les's point about, and the commentary going on about, USCDI might not be the exact right approach, but we do need to figure out an approach to deal with something like a pandemic, right? Like there has to be at least thought of, you know, the approach and how things like this could work. One thing that I think is very interesting with something like COVID too is a lot of the base resources and infrastructure for sharing those exist, right? Like sharing labs, sharing observations, et cetera. It really comes down to things like, well, are the labs being blink encoded? If they're not, are they being mapped at the source? And I do think there's a not to say that USCDI has to be the force that helps address this, but it would really be a shame if there wasn't at least one thread in this task force in the HITAC to look at, well, what can HITAC do to help address this instead of basically, you know, talking about the fact that we need to address it each time we meet.
That's actually a fair point. And I think that actually kind of goes to another question that I know floating around here, which are, what are the next steps for the USCDI task force, Ken? This may actually help speak to that, right? So what are that? What is that? What does that look like? Because that will be the action items that the HITAC takes, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's things like, well, you know, can we be sure that if we use the immunization resource and share immunization data, the information that's needed for vaccine passports or knowing whether people are sufficiently protected when they need to be come back for a revaccination, is it there? Are there, you know, symptoms that are highly, you know, suggestive that we might want to encode? And, you know, we have to keep in mind things like what Clem always brings up and he's brought up too, like we don't now want clinicians to have to check box saying the patient has lost sense of smell, right, in a new checks box, because that would be kind of crazy. I mean, it might be important, but it would add so much additional burden. But I think it is something to think about. And, you know, there's probably low-hanging fruit in the area, but I think the USCDI process in general has not really addressed the notion of, well, when we really need these valley sets to be properly mapped to and coded, how do we make that happen? And I think that's a completely it's hard to really address when you're boiling the ocean, but if it's in terms of how do we make sure that the valley sets are properly used for these four vaccines, that becomes very doable. So I think it could also address this issue of how do we look within a data element to make sure that the bindings of terminologies for things we really care about are really universally being done.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So let me ask this general question. What is the next steps here? Let's clarify that. How do we get the USCDI task force back together, get it going, so we can answer some of these questions and work through the details of this? What does that look like? Maybe I'll turn it over to ONC. Do you want to, maybe you guys can clarify for us?
Sure. Happy to jump in here, Aaron. So in terms of kind of next steps for the task force, we are assuming that if you were on the prior task force that you are, in fact, still interested. Just a quick review of the member list of those that are still on the committee. Terry O'Malley, who served as one of the co-chairs, Valerie Gray, Ken Kawamoto, Stephen Lane, Les Leonard, Clem Donald, Brett Oliver, Sasha Termont, and Cheryl Turney. So if you're no longer available, just shoot me a note and let me know. I've heard from a couple of members who are interested in serving as co-chair alongside Terry. But I will confirm that offline. And then we are looking to start the task force perhaps in the next couple of weeks or so once we get schedules and everything lined up. And then, as Al mentioned, we'll try to wrap up in time for the April due date in terms for final recommendations.
Yeah, that's great, Lauren. Is it possible for folks to take, I think this is a great presentation, maybe get some thoughts on paper or on email and send it over to Al or send it over to ONC to sort of collect those thoughts ahead of time in advance of the task force being spun back up?
Sure, that'd be great.
Yeah, so that might be a way for folks to just collect their thoughts. I didn't want to miss this. I know, Clem, you have another comment. You have your hand raised. Did you have another comment to make?
Yeah, yes, I do. I think, you know, there's two parts of it. We won't know what's needed more for some things until the USCDI kind of comes into force, which I guess is still 18 months away. or something like that. But I think that when you launch something, the next step is to figure out how it's doing. And I don't know that the task force can actually do that, but we could encourage the development of kind of watching processes. So how well is stuff being coded is to Ken's question. What really is happening? There's some aspirational things that if we had a lot more code, we could do more with it. But is that true? And to the point about, are we sending too much stuff out? Can we tell? Can we look? And if, you know, and who's, or is anybody complaining? Or can we look at it and figure out what's going on so that we could do this instead of guessing into the future? We could kind of understand where there are problems and where things are succeeding and not.
Those are great, great comments, Clem. And I will add, as I often do for the high tech, some real world story, just adding the vaccines, even before they were finally approved in the FDA and CDC processes, just getting the SNOMED codes lined up and entered into the various EMRs that we all use took some hoops and hurdles because that was a challenge. They were not final codes. They were not finally approved. It took some arm twisting just so we could begin planning processes for boots on the ground. So the more we can have clarity on standards and where that data goes and the privacy of it, the easier it becomes to add something as simple as a vaccine, even in almost approved status, into the EMRs and other systems as appropriate, which will help everything across the board. So I can appreciate those comments.
Well, that raises another issue because I understood that there's another set of codes for vaccines from CDC. So are we having dueling code systems for vaccines?
Right. No, you're exactly right. There's a whole lot of that has to be worked through. I think that echoes everything that we're trying to say here, which is that the landscape is still coming together. But I also do want to highlight the phenomenal work that even version one was, right? You've got to start somewhere. And so I think to what the Posner and others said, it was a bowling ball, you know, it went down and didn't hit every pin, but it hit a lot of them. And now we get to roll again and just keep going until we get this right.
Yeah, I agree. You're here.
All right. So I want to ask one more time if there's any other questions. We have about 3 minutes left before the break. You know, if there's anybody on the phone that would like to speak up and ask a question, please do.
Oh, wait a minute. Don't disagree. Sorry.
Okay. So with that, I don't know, Denise, is there, I don't see anybody else in the chat unless I'm missing something here on my computer. All right.
So we're good. We're up. We're caught up with questions.
We are caught up with questions. All right, so we've got about 2 minutes left. We can give folks that time back to just grab an extra sandwich or whatever along with the break. Lauren, do you think that will work?
That sounds great.
All right, folks. Well, then let's get to that. I'm sorry. I saw Jim Gergis just raised his hand. Jim?
Yeah, one just brief comment that I think is resonating with people in the chat is there's that I just want to get on the to voice in case people can't read the chat is this notion that all of our interoperability goals are contingent upon the public trusting the system and just this notion of oversharing and going beyond minimal necessary will be important to address so that we don't cross what we're calling sort of the creepiness factor where suddenly we start getting the public awakened to the idea that their information, including HIV results or other things, are being overshared, setting back the goals of interoperability. And that seemed to be something the task force ought to think about as USCDI starts to expand.
Great point. Yeah, don't be creepy with your technology. I like that. Okay, on that comment, we are going to take a break then, and we will be back in 15 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Great. Welcome back, everyone. At this point, we would like to turn it over to Alex Muggy, Director and Deputy Chief Health Informatics Officer at CMS, followed by additional remarks from Steve Posnack, our Deputy National Coordinator. Alex?
All right. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for having us here today. I'm going to briefly go through our proposed rule for the CMS interoperability and prior authorization. This proposed rule, the comment period actually closed on January 4th, so the comment period is closed, but I'd like to just walk you through the policies and share what we are looking at. So if we go to the next slide. Oh, one more. Three. All right. Jumping in with a patient access API. So this is actually a policy that we had finalized in the first interoperability rule, or the interoperability and patient access final rule. We finalized this as a policy that payers would implement a FHIR-based patient access API. And in this rule, we're building on and expanding that API policy by requiring payers to include information about patients pending and active prior authorization decisions. So in the first rule, we had required claims and encounter and some clinical information be shared. We're now adding prior authorization. I just want to make sure, can everybody hear me okay? Because I sound like someone's trying to interrupt. Okay, just want to make sure. So as I said, we're adding some additional information to the API by requiring that prior authorization information be included. We are also proposing to require several IGs that would support the patient access API. We had previously encouraged the use of these IGs and are now proposing to require them to help support and streamline these APIs, this API build. So that includes for claims and encounter information, we had proposed the Karen for Blue Button IG. And for the USCDI and clinical information, we had proposed the DaVinci Payer Data Exchange, or PDEX IG. And for formulary, we had proposed the Payer Data Exchange, or PDEX Drug Formulary IG. These IGs would be supportive of the patient access build, and these IGs you will hear repeated throughout this presentation because we had proposed them for each of our, what I will call our access APIs. In addition to sort of the technical build of the API, we had also proposed that impacted payers would be required to establish an attestation process whereby payers could request or require third-party application developers to attest to certain privacy policy provisions prior to connecting to the payer's API to retrieve patient data. So this privacy policy attestation is a significant new add to the patient access API and would just allow a bit more transparency for patients into what is required in a third-party applications privacy attestation or privacy policies and would get the payers a little bit more involved in working with the patient on the privacy policies of these third-party applications. Then finally for this section, we'd also proposed for payers to report certain metrics on a quarterly basis about the adoption of the patient access API and how many patients they have using this API to access their information. Each of these policies was proposed to be effective on January 1, 2023. I don't have a slide for it, but also kind of included in this section in the proposed rule, we had proposed also that payers use the DaVinci Payer Data Exchange or PDEX PlanNet implementation guide to support the provider directory API that we had finalized in the first interoperability rule as well. So I just want to highlight that that's another IG that we would be proposing to require for the provider directory API. And if we go to the next slide, I don't know, I don't think that we had it on there. No, but just wanted to highlight again that that was another piece of the puzzle that was included in the proposed rule. But on this slide, and going into the next API that we had proposed, we proposed to require that impacted payers would build a provider access API that would provide payer-to-provider data sharing of Again, it's similar to the patient access API, so it includes claims and encounter data. This would not include costs. So payer, unlike for the patients having access to cost data through the API, providers would not have that cost data included. We also proposed that the API would include clinical data as defined in the USCDI version 1, and as well including pending and active prior authorization decisions. So in many ways, this is very similar to the patient access API. We also proposed to use the same implementation guides to support this API. In addition to the sort of individual API for this purpose, we'll call it, we also proposed the use of the HL7 FHIR bulk data access specification to facilitate the data sharing for more than one patient at a time. Each of these pieces of the API puzzle would be finalized or implemented on January 1, 2023. That is what we have proposed for all of those pieces of the Provider Access API. And if we can go to the next slide covers our payer-to-payer policy. So we also propose what I'm still calling, I guess, our trio of access APIs. We have patient access, provider access, and then we have payer-to-payer API. We had proposed in the first interoperability rule, we finalized a requirement whereby payers would exchange certain patient data when a patient changes health plans, and that at a patient's request, a patient could ask for their data to move from their old payer to their new payer. We encouraged the use of an API for this purpose, but we did not require it in the first interoperability rule. And in this interoperability and prior authorization rule, we are now proposing to require that this exchange be done via a FHIR-based API. I'm going to sound like I'm on repeat here, but as part of the payer-to-payer API, we also included claims and encounter data, a subset of the clinical data as defined by the USCDI version 1, as well as pending and active prior authorization decisions. So all of the same data that patients and providers would have access to would also go from payer to payer. One difference here in terms of the implementation for this API, we did propose the use of the PCDEIG for the prior authorization data exchange. We also proposed that payers would exchange this data not just at a patient's request, but also at a time of enrollment. If the payer has an enrollment period, that they would send the data or make available the data via API for those patients that are changing payers at the time of enrollment. We also proposed for this API the HL7 bulk specification, again, for exchanges of large amounts of patient data, as we understand that during enrollment, this could be useful when exchanging data on multiple patients. And again, we propose that this API would be implemented by January 1, 2023. So all three of those access APIs kind of working together to make sure that patients, providers, and payers all have the information that they need at the time that they need it. And just better support transparency for the patients and help them to achieve better care and better care outcomes. If we can go to the next slide. As part of the payer-to-payer API, we had sought comment on whether the new payers should consider information from old payers regarding prior authorization. So kind of breaking that down a little bit, we encouraged payers to look at the data that they're receiving from a previous payer to help them assess a patient's needs and health status. And we sought comment on whether payers should be limited from requiring repeat tests and evaluations when it comes to prior authorization. So if you have a patient who has a prior authorization under one payer and has an ongoing prior authorization, when they move to the new payer, to what extent, we were asking, should that patient have to redo some of the tests and procedures to prove that they still need that prior authorization, or to what extent should that be considered already done from the data received from the previous payer? So we did seek comments on that, and we received comment on that, and we did not make any proposals, but just wanted to highlight that that is something that we were seeking comment on and appreciate all the commenters' feedback. We can go to the next slide. I'm actually not going to cover this slide. I believe Steve is going to cover this in a couple minutes, but just because I keep referencing all of these IGs, I just wanted to give a shout out to ONC and thank them for joining us in this process as they are proposing to adopt all of these standards in their regulation text. And Steve will talk about that in just a moment. So shout out. Hey, ONC, thank you. Go into the next slide. Okay, so in addition to what I've been calling the access APIs, we also proposed two prior authorization APIs to help streamline the prior authorization process and really reduce some of the burden that we've been hearing from payers and providers and patients alike around this process. So the first API we proposed was the Documentation Requirements Lookup Service, or DRLS API. We have heard quite extensively from providers that finding requirements, documentation requirements and requirements for prior authorization can be quite onerous, that payers store these requirements in various places on their websites. They can be very hard to find. So we propose that payers would build the DRLS API, which would allow providers to look up those requirements using, if their EHR is connected to the API, it would allow them to locate those requirements directly in their EHR. So this API would use the CRD and DTR IGs under the DaVinci project. And again, if a provider has this built out in their EHR, they can connect to the API, and instead of having to search for the payer's requirements, they'd be able to pull those back directly, thereby streamlining some of the process and cutting back on some of the time that that providers use trying to locate these requirements. And then the second API that we proposed for prior authorization is the Prior Authorization Support, or PAS API, which uses the PAS IG, or would leverage the PAS IG if implemented. So we are proposing to require payers would build this FHIR-enabled electronic prior authorization support API that would have the ability to send and receive prior authorization request responses electronically directly within a provider's workflow. So again, this would require that providers have this built out in their EHRs, but once available, that EHR would be able to connect directly to the payer to exchange prior authorization requests and responses, significantly cutting out some of the additional paperwork required there for prior authorization. And if we can go to the next slide, we think we have a visual on the next slide to kind of represent this a little bit better. So some of you may be asking yourselves, like, what about HIPAA? HIPAA defines the X12-278 standard for prior authorization because this is a HIPAA transaction. Prior authorization is a HIPAA transaction. And we have already defined that the X12-278 is the standard for that transaction. So this slide sort of demonstrates how we are maintaining the integrity of those HIPAA standards. And as you can see here, the PAS IG sort of sandwiches the X12-278 between the FHIR-enabled PAS IG on either side, on the payer and provider side of the transaction. So this is just a visual to help you see how 278 is still very much involved in this process, and how we are maintaining the integrity of the HIPAA transaction standard in this proposed API. Okay, and if we can go to the next slide. I am trying to power through this because I know that Steve has a few slides as well, and we wanted to leave some time for questions. But certainly we're happy to follow up with anyone if we don't have time to get to questions here today. So in addition to all of these APIs that I've been talking about, we also proposed several guardrails around the prior authorization process to help sort of support the process and help streamline it and reduce some of the burden and also improve transparency around prior authorization. So here on this slide are a couple of the things that we had proposed. One is the denial reason. We are proposing to require that payers include a denial reason for a prior authorization request. And I want to highlight that this is regardless of the method used for that the provider used to submit the request. So So we know that there are still existing mechanisms out there for submitting prior authorization, you know, aside from the APIs that we, you know, would hope to be in place on January 1, 2023. We understand that payers also do prior authorization through fax, portals, phone. There are lots of different ways to do it, but you know, regardless of that method, we would be proposing to require this denial reason be submitted if a request is denied. And the purpose there is really to ensure that providers have the information they need to either submit an appeal or resubmit their request or work with their patient to explain why the request has been denied and find alternate courses of treatment. But they really need that information in order to be able to do that. We also propose shorter prior authorization timeframes. So we had proposed that impacted payers would have up to 72 hours for urgent requests and 7 calendar days for standard prior authorization requests. This is a significant reduction from what we understand to be in practice today. Specifically, we understand that in many places for Medicaid, it's a 14-day turnaround. So we would be cutting that in half. And this is to ensure that patients are getting timely care and that providers are saving time by not having to continually follow up on their requests, but they're getting their turnaround on their requests more timely. We also proposed that payers would publicly report certain metrics about prior authorization. For example, the percent of prior authorization requests that are approved and denied. So I think there are about 7 metrics that we had proposed, and this is to provide more transparency into the prior authorization process for each of the payers, and that will help patients to understand what their payers' prior authorization processes look like. It will also help providers to understand, you know, if they're contracting with a provider, like sort of not necessarily what to expect, but just to give some context on what the overall prior authorization landscape looks like with these payers. So just a couple of guardrails in place and some transparency here to open up some of the process a bit more. And then if we can go to the next slide, we also included several RFIs. I don't need to talk through each one of these on the slide, but I do want to highlight the third bullet down, I believe here, the reducing burden and improving electronic information exchange of documentation and prior authorization. So we did seek comment on ways to encourage or require providers to use the prior authorization APIs that are proposed in this rule. So it's one thing to require the payers to build these APIs, but we also want to ensure that those APIs are being used and integrated with EHRs and can be used by providers. So we did seek comment on that. And we did receive some excellent feedback from the public, so look forward to some more on that front, but just wanted to make sure I highlighted that before wrapping up. So the comment period for this rule is closed. We've received lots of comments and have already read through them and gotten some excellent feedback from stakeholders, and we are very grateful for that. But if anyone has any questions or feedback, I'm happy to take those after Steve presents his slides or follow up at a later time. So thank you very much, and over to you, Steve.
All right, thanks, Alex. And I got my camera on. I appreciate going after the break. It gave me a chance to get some touch-ups at hair and makeup. So thanks, everybody, and kudos to Lauren and Richie for the timing. So I'm going to sit on this slide for 1 second and just use the mic to congratulate and thank Dr. Rucker for his time with us, his service to the country. He happens to be, a couple factoids, the longest-serving national coordinator we have ever had. He also happens to be the only national coordinator that you all have had at HITECH. And that is just, remarkable in terms of, his commitment to our mission, his dedication to the work that we have. There are many other things that we could pile on to compliment Don, but I just wanted to thank him personally. He obviously served for him in different roles during my time at ONC with him, and I just very much appreciate his leadership and all the things that we were able to accomplish the past 4 years. So one of the things that, as Alex touched on, that we have continued to strengthen our relationship with CMS, and this collaborative effort through the recent proposed rulemaking reflects that. And so it's a coordination opportunity for us with our colleagues at CMS, where there's that intersection between the clinical and administrative area, The ICAD task force, since we like to speak in acronyms, right? Many of the things that you recommended are embodied and referenced as part of this proposed rulemaking. And those are things that we took into account as well. So we can flip over to the next slide, please, because I'm starting to steal my thunder. We also accompanied as part of CMS's rule, as Alex mentioned, and we use our general authority on behalf of the secretary to adopt standards and implementation specifications. We referenced all of those implementation guides that Alex mentioned. And so we've included them as part of the new section for standards and implementation specifications that we referenced for application programming interfaces. We created kind of a new subparagraph for that. And importantly, this is something that's existed in the HITECH Act that we have not necessarily had the opportunity to do in a cross-department way as much as we would have liked. But this was a perfect opportunity for us to work together with CMS and that convergence of the two worlds. And I wanted to emphasize, so we can independently adopt standards and implementation specifications, which we've done to a small degree in the past. But an important point is that there are no new associated or revised certification criteria that go along with these proposals. And so they are purely, at this stage, standards that are being adopted and as part of our kind of Code of Federal Regulation text, in service to the department's policy needs that CMS has established for their rulemaking as part of the proposals. Alex already covered in great detail, as she always does, when we both have the power through presentations, the implementation guides that were included in the proposed rule. As I mentioned again, I want to thank all of the work that the ICAD task force did and the HITECH overall for its deliberations associated with a lot of the material that covered these, the rules and the proposals. And the next slide that I have, which you don't need to go to, is just a listing of the implementation guides, but that's available for everybody's reference, and we'll try to save a few minutes for dialogue.
Thank you, Alex and Steve. I know we have a few people with their hands up for questions, and I put my hand up first, so I'm going to take the liberty of making the first comment. And I also want to say I do recognize that this rule is not final and that you might not necessarily be able to comment or answer all of our questions, but at least be able to get input from us. So, while this rule has some really great features, I think one of the things that is problematic, in the ideal, we would want this to apply to all payers across all benefit plans. And as I understand it, it doesn't apply to Medicare Advantage. It is just CMS-regulated payers, which is what you have authority over. And one concern for us in the provider community and for patients as well is because it doesn't apply to the commercial side of the business for payers, you would think that if they're going to implement these things and do the work that they would use it across their different benefit plans to ease the burden on the provider organization so that they don't have to have multiple workflows to support. Because while a lot of these features will be really nice for the provider side of the house, until there's uniformity where all the payers have to do this, it certainly is not going to be a huge benefit to the provider side of the equation or necessarily to the patients in terms of them. For instance, if a patient's in Medicaid and then they get a job and then they're able to get commercial coverage, while there's a requirement for the Medicaid payer to send the information to the other payer, if that person falls back in Medicaid, there's no requirement for that other payer to send them information as I understand it. So that's just my overhead comments. I'm sure I'm not the only one that has this sentiment given the makeup of our committee.
So if it's all right, I would like to just go ahead and kind of respond to that, just using pretty much words from the proposed rule. So there's just kind of reiterating, but we do understand the desire for this to apply uniformly across payers. We can only control those payers that are within our scope, which would include Medicare Advantage. This rule did not include Medicare Advantage, and I probably should have been more clear about that up front in the first slides as well. So this does only apply to Medicaid and CHIP, fee-for-service and managed care, as well as the QHPs. We did include some discussion in the proposed rule regarding Medicare Advantage and the potential for looking at this for future rulemaking. But we also discussed that, you know, we believe that if payers are going to implement these policies, you know, that they may have an interest in applying them across their other lines of business. And nothing about our proposed rule would discourage payers from doing that. So, you know, we highly encourage that if they have multiple lines of business, that they roll this out so that we can get to that uniformity. And because we believe this will reduce burden on both sides of the equation. You know, it'll make it easier for providers, certainly, if they can do all of this from their EHR. But, you know, even on the payer side as well, just getting all of the information in that format in a Firebase API will make things better for them as well, so which will help them get to those reduced timeframes for turnaround. So I think all of this does work together, and we understand the concerns, but I thank you for raising them and giving me the opportunity just to clarify where our thoughts are and going and where we're going to go with that.
Well, thank you, Alex. And I know Aaron also raised his hand, but I'm going to let Jim go next and then you, Aaron.
All right. I suppose Jim can go first. Go ahead.
I feel an obligation to defer to the co-chair.
No, sir, please. Go ahead.
This is wonderful stuff. And, you know, I share your sentiment that Don Rucker's influence has been just, I mean, it's been a tectonic plate shift. And so just much gratitude and appreciation. Love what I'm seeing in this. One question I had is around the notion of within the workflow, the providers having an opportunity to have access to what the rules are for a particular request. And then on the flip side, there being a specific reason for denial. How is there any thought on how to define that so it doesn't end up meeting the rule but still not being specific enough to allow providers to understand how to change what they're doing to either reduce denials or reduce requests? So both of them are about how do we go far enough with specificity that we don't end up right where we were with just different synonyms that mean nothing?
That's a great question. And I think there is some work to be done there, and we've tossed around a few ideas, I think, on particularly those denial reasons. But I think that's a great discussion to be had. And thanks for raising it.
Yeah. So we have Aaron and Arian. If you both, Aaron, if you could go ahead, and then Arian, and then I think we need to move to our next presenter.
Sure. So I'll go quick. So two quick questions. Number one, I just want to confirm that in this, the intent is that either on the provider side or on the payer side, that there's not some exorbitant fee to use this interface. This is kind of part and parcel of transactional costs. This isn't something that suddenly me as a provider system has to pay some special fee for, or if I'm leveraging my EMR vendor to do transactional costs, which a lot of vendors do that as an offering. There's not some special like modifier that goes on top of this that suddenly I'm paying more money to use this interface. Is that correct? So this is kind of just normal standard business. Is that right? Is that the intent?
Well, that would be, you know, that would be what we would be looking for. I don't know, Steve, if you have any additional feedback on particular fees, but no, yeah. So that would be our understanding. This is the cost of doing business, you know, but there shouldn't be a fee per using the API over, you know, fax or some other means.
Sure. And I understand intent versus what happens in the real world. So I appreciate that. And I applaud going this way. So the second quick question is this. That I want to give a kind of real world scenario for you. Right now, we're trying to vaccinate, you know, thousands of people a day. We're shooting for an audacious goal of 100,000 people vaccinated at via UT Austin for the Austin Metroplex in the next 30 days or so, if possible. One of the issues we've run into is reimbursement and the need for auth for certain types of payer for certain types of plans for people who are coming in just for the labor costs. Right, we're not charging for vaccine. But each of them basically tell us, oh, you've got a unique circumstance depending on, you know, whoever it is, insurance company. Would this mean for this subset of payers that they would all have to align their pre-auth and prior auth processes so that it all looks and feels the same so that I can begin to get more throughput on a faster method?
So I can't speak to, you know, the particulars of this, you know, your vaccination effort and the things that are happening there and how that may vary. But just in terms of prior authorization policies, like across the board, we did not propose and would not be requiring payers to standardize their prior authorization policies or procedures. However, I would think that some of that standardization would happen naturally through the fact that this would be going through an EHR, through an API. So once this is sort of in the FHIR format using the IGs, some of that standardization will happen naturally. That doesn't change that, you know, one payer may request 100 data elements to do a prior authorization and another one may only request 10, and those may be a different 10. You know, we didn't go there. So, you know, I know there will be continued discussion in that area.
Got it. Thank you very much for clarification.
Arian, if you have a quick question, otherwise I would kindly ask those who are still in the queue for hands up, if we could defer your questions to after we finish going over the work plan, if we have time to then take your questions, just to be respectful to Bakul, who's here to start his presentation.
Sure. So first of all, just really appreciate the work. As Steve noted, this really does follow the ICAD task force. A couple of concerns on process, making sure that we've got enough time for comment, making sure that we've got the ability to kind of scour the rule and go through it and provide appropriate comment. I think the comment period and the timeline has been I think a little accelerated potentially by the impending administration transition, and I don't think that's helpful for what's going to end up being a long-running set of policy requirements. The second comment is the one piece in the ICAD task force that appears to be missing is the naming of an attachment standard. You know, I think if you look at what's required to do EPA, we're going to need to make sure that we have a standard for attachments to get the clinical documentation over, as well as the EPA guidance. And then I think the last comment is that relevant for fees as a clearinghouse, I think we would note that there are going to be some transactional fees associated with getting the 278 from a provider to a payer, a recognition that there's additional work that's required to make all these transactions happen. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we are going to transition to the presentation on the FDA's Digital Health Center, and we welcome Bakul Patel to give that presentation.
Thank you so much, Denise. Can you guys hear me clearly?
Yes.
Great. I'm not sure what the protocol is. If you want me to turn on my video, I'm happy to do so as well. Let me just try that.
Video is new for all of us, so there you go. You get to help us figure it out.
Thanks. First of all, thank you so much for having me present and share sort of an overview of our Center of Excellence we just launched in September of 22nd. I do want to echo Steve's comment from earlier about Don's sort of leadership with ONC, and really appreciate a great partnership the FDA had had, especially the Device Center had had with Steve and everybody at ONC. So thank you so much for that. You'll be missed, Don, for sure, and all the thought leadership that you had provided. Having said that, I think let me just walk through a little bit of sort of the overview and sort of the intentions around this and sort of how it all started. Hopefully that provides enough context for us for a robust conversation after I just walk through some of the slides. So the Digital Health Center of Excellence, you know, it's been a journey, I call that personally, from, you know, starting with, you know, our very first guidance document on mobile medical apps that eventually evolved into multiple policies that give the rise of this group that we installed at the Center for Devices at FDA. And, you know, it became apparent for us that this is something that we need to take it further. So let me just share that with you. But as you can imagine, the scope and the words of digital health seems pretty broad. So I hope I can provide you a little bit of context of sort of the focus areas of where FDA is thinking about. So on the next slide, I'll just walk through some of the topics that I want to cover. Is I want to share sort of what we are thinking in terms of the scope of the spectrum that we see as digital health. I think it fits squarely in conjunction with health information technology, but it's just one piece of the puzzle as we start moving towards this digital care, as people call it these days, right? And then, you know, what we are thinking about from what do we want to achieve by having the Center of Excellence stand up, and then where we are starting off and what are we going to do further. On the next slide, you'll start seeing sort of a depiction of how I have been thinking about and we have been thinking about at FDA. It's really a continuum. And as the convergence of connectivity, data, and computing power is coming together, either in the form of an EHR or some clinical decision support or some other software that's tracking and tracing COVID sort of tests or vaccinations for that matter, or any other thing, is really becoming a continuum that we're going to build this platform of care on top of this digital economy and the connections that exist. Now, from a very pure FDA-centric view, we are seeing from a products perspective and sort of where the care is heading, we are seeing this movement from the clinics itself to the patients, so becoming more patient-centered, and very much from a diagnostics and a medical products perspective, you're seeing the understanding physiology of patients in the wild is becoming much more relevant, and not just during care, but also during clinical trials and other aspects. And then the hope is, you know, with these powerful technologies, these predictions, we can start focusing on prevention earlier and earlier with smaller and smaller interventions. So that's sort of the scope of what we've been thinking about. So if you go to the next slide, you can start seeing sort of how we are focusing on things. When it becomes a medical product, it's even though the spectrum is from healthy living to management of care after it happens, we can see that a product or a technology can become a medical product. It could be a device. It could be a combination of a drug or a device. It could be incorporated in there. So you're seeing chip-on-pills kind of technology happening as we speak. And in the process of making those medical products, so the manufacturing systems of drugs and devices, they're starting to use very, emerging technologies that will start predicting failures and other aspects that are going to be important for the safety and effectiveness of the products that we regulate is something that we are focusing on. And then I want to highlight some of the couple things that are sort of emerging, especially in the pandemic. There was a big demand for doing clinical trials remotely. And in studying medical product, either it's a drug or a device remotely, with these technologies, that's going to give you different insights is something that we are focusing on as well. And the last but not the least is so the emergence of digital therapeutics, either their combination with a drug, either with a device or other aspects that may be actioned that may just provide a different type of therapy is something emerging. And as we are thinking about this, we're looking down the future, how best to start thinking about that, what's the best mechanisms to look for evidence and so on and so forth. On the next slide, you can start seeing, as we're thinking through this, this has been part of our planned evolution for digital health. In 2017, when we had our budget appropriations, we were asked by Congress to stand this up. I mean, it took us a little bit, and then pandemic happened, so things slow down, as you can imagine. But it's really the intent is to drive synergy, have one conversation, or at least a place to have a conversation on digital health at FDA, or at least when it relates to medical products. We want to make sure that our strategies, both within FDA and sort of the research community and other communities, are aligned in sort of where we can take these technologies for the future. And, you know, selfishly speaking, how do we get FDA prepared for this digital health future? And that's really where we started off with the conversation with. On the next slide, you'll see, and I'll run through this quickly as much as possible. This is where we ended. This is our goal. we want to empower all stakeholders to advance healthcare when they're starting using digital health as one of the things that they want to incorporate into their care. And how are we going to do that? From our very small perspective, is we want to connect and build partnerships like we are talking today. We want to share knowledge. That means bidirectional for both for FDA as well as FDA sharing what our expectations are and what we are seeing. Connecting patients, connecting providers, connecting researchers together is something that we want to sort of do. And internally, we want to start innovating on our regulatory approaches. And as we start seeing some of this, efforts sort of going forward, we believe those three big goals or big three ambitious goals will drive the empowerment of all stakeholders. And I think it's important for FDA to start leaning forward to start making those available and making those sort of known what's in the best interest of public health. On the next slide, here's some of the outcomes we are hoping. And this is just a few and a handful I picked to just share where our thinking is. We want to sort of get access to expertise because we know no one agency or no one entity can hold all the expertise. And we want to connect that. We also want to make sure that we are increasing awareness and understanding of where evidence matters, where evidence is important, what evidence is important. And we start thinking and thinking about what are the hurdles, what are the opportunities that we can sort of remove. And then consistent application of our paradigms, our regulatory approaches within our agency as well. So these are some few outcomes we are hoping to sort of get. It's going to be a journey for us for sure. We are starting, this is a starting point in the next chapter of how FDA is looking at emerging technologies. On the next slide. So people ask like, oh, is it going to be all in the group that I'm leading? And the answer is no. And the whole concept of this center of excellence is really taking a very broad view, but also building a virtual infrastructure. Just like the blue boxes here are showing that what my group does on a day-to-day basis, but there are many other things that are happening outside of my group. For example, digital pathology, virtual reality and augmented reality, in silico modeling of clinical trials that can help advance clinical trials in a better way. And then advanced manufacturing, I just talked about cybersecurity, which goes in hand with our interoperability sort of initiatives. So bringing it all together, making this one place to start thinking about how do we sort of connect. So I'm going to share with you a little bit of how we are thinking to coordinate internally, and making plans towards coordination externally as well, working with the Office of the National Coordinator. And other entities who have been very interested in advancing this field. So on the next slide, here's sort of a visual view of how we are thinking of coordination. Of course, with the bottom box is talking about creating this virtual organization, but then internally within the device center, there's so many things happening that's touching, that is digital health that's touching every product area from ophthalmology to orthopedics to cardiology and so on. And we want to make sure that we are consistent in application of those policies. We are in science and so on and so forth. FDA-wide, we also want to look from not just from drugs and devices and biologics, but also how we can help veterinary medicine, for example, or food supplies that may actually be helpful from a digital health perspective, because it all comes down to my initial, when I said the spectrum from healthy living to managing patients. And we may have some loose and distant connections, but at least we want to make sure that we are staying connected in some areas versus others. On the next line, I wanted to go through some of the specific services the Center of Excellence is trying to stand up. From a device perspective, since most of this work has been starting and emerging from the medical device world, where software is a medical device and software can be inside a medical device. We've been working towards setting the right strategic direction for digital health, making sure we are coordinating our regulatory science and research priorities, making sure we are creating shared resources. So it's when a reviewer in Division A looking at orthopedics, for example, has an AI question, they can pull on this service to provide, get understanding and resources from another AI who has been experiencing the same thing. So making that connection point is the intent. If you go on the next slide, you'll start seeing how this can also help other parts of the agency. From FDA-wide perspective, we also want to support the drugs mission, because the drug regulations are different than device regulations, but we want to support their advancement as well. We want to make sure that we aligned in terms of, you know, spending our right resources on what research areas that we need to work on. For example, wearables have been a really hot topic for use in clinical trials all along. But the biggest question we get asked is, what's the validity of those? How much you can rely on those on those endpoints? And so those thorny questions have not gone away. And we're looking to find ways to synergize on that. Also making sure that we don't end up creating, not just we, but all the community does not end up validating it over and over again when you're thinking about a product versus another product. How do you make sure that the research community can sort of align on those? And then, you know, external to FDA, we want to make sure that we are partnering, we are coordinating, we are hearing and learning from each other, not just the federal entities, but also outside of the federal entities, including industry, healthcare provider organizations, and researchers for that matter. On the next slide, and I just have a couple other slides. So just to give you what I just talked about, I probably stole my own thunder here. Providing clarity on regulation is going to be really, really important for all stakeholders outside of FDA. Just understanding how we are approaching digital health, which seems foreign to a lot of people when it comes down to software as a medical device or what vocabulary you want to use, it becomes really important for us to be that, you know, common place for people to come, common place for people to understand what we are sort of intending and so on. We do not, I don't see the Center of Excellence doing reviews. We are not set up to do that. The reviews and the product approvals and authorizations will happen as it happens today, but we are going to become the as a service to help and support those different offices to meet the authorizations. And I do want to touch upon international harmonization. So one of the unique aspects of digital health and software is it does not know boundaries. You know, where you can download products from, it does not really matter, but where it's used matters. And so when it comes to US and when it comes down to regulations, the questions we are having from an FDA perspective for these technologies are the same questions other regulators as well. And they also struggle slightly in a different way on privacy and security aspects of it. And so in some aspects they have an advantage because some countries have single payer systems and we don't, and we have a different mechanism here. But I think harmonizing internationally and making sure that our approaches are aligned and in some aspects leading some of those activities is going to be some of the efforts that we'll be working on. On the next slide, just to give you a roadmap, I mean, we just launched in the fall of 2020. We are starting to operationalize this infrastructure in place. We are literally starting small. We're starting internal to CDRH with devices. We're starting to coordinate this virtualness. And we're starting to build that same infrastructure FDA-wide. We already have some connections with that we collaborate on an ongoing basis with ONC, with FCC and FTC and OCR. We'll continue to do that. But I think at this point, we are looking at what other opportunities are out there that can help us all get aligned in the space, at least be informative of where FDA can be. And that's really the goal, and hoping that when it comes to digital health and comes to FDA regulations of digital health, the Center of Excellence becomes a one-stop shop for those activities for any stakeholders at any point in time, that's the hope. And we want to create that infrastructure of the knowledge infrastructure and then the access infrastructure to FDA for that. I think that was my last line, if not mistaken. Can go to the next slide. Yes, that was my last slide. So I hope we have some time left for Q&A. I would be happy to take some questions.
Thank you so much, but appreciate that very much. I know we're getting very, very close to time, so maybe we can take one or two questions max, but I'm sure folks can follow up with you here. Clem, I see you have your hand raised. You want to ask a quick question? And then Carolyn Peterson after that. Clem?
Yeah, well, just a minute. I'm having trouble.
Okay. I'll
do it on the trick.
Okay. Carolyn, your turn.
Thanks, Bickful, for a really interesting and informative presentation. I am interested in learning more about how you plan to include patient and consumer representatives in your initiatives and how you will be using their feedback going forward on a regular basis.
Great question, and I apologize for not mentioning it. In fact, we have a patient engagement advisory committee that we have stood up. It's very young, and that's exactly where we want to get patients and individuals to sort of opine on our approaches and policies. So if you haven't missed it, about a couple months ago, we actually held an advisory committee meeting on AI/ML and what does it mean for machine learning software to patients when they're seeing it or when their clinicians are using it. So we had a robust discussion on what does that mean to be transparent to the end user? How is the machine learning software telling, and how does the user know they're getting what they are getting and how they should be incorporating? So absolutely, Carolina, you're spot on, and I'm apologies for not mentioning it.
And if I could ask a follow-on question, what are your plans for engaging with the HITACH and leveraging the resources and expertise we bring to further that patient and consumer engagement and perspective in the process?
Yeah, so I think since this is so nascent and new off the ground, definitely I'm very keen on figuring out how we can create this channel of engagement with HITACH. And it's going to be extremely helpful as we move forward. In fact, I recognize Jim, who was talking earlier. Jim and I had many conversations. Donna had many conversations. I want to continue this. I think this, the richness of this committee will probably be very helpful for us to not only inform, but also learn from you guys what are the needs, what are the demands, and how we think we should be being on our mission of promoting and protecting public health. So absolutely, Carolyn, and ideas are welcome. How do you do this on a regular basis would be very much welcome for us to consider as we're still building it.
So Bakul, thank you very much. It's a great, great presentation. I have a question. So, in my capacity at the University of Texas at Austin, as CIO, we have a number of research projects as well as clinical operations, as you can imagine, that leverage devices, consumer devices and whatnot in the field. And there's oftentimes, especially on the research side, that we are working with a PI who's trying to work through what's the right device, what gives me the best fidelity, what actually is the right applicability, because the market is so broad and that's a wonderful thing. Would this group for FDA also be a sort of a sounding board for, hey, we're trying to do a study with, in our case, we're looking at child psychology and using consumer devices in the field to try to monitor sleep time and those types of things and how that affects from a clinical perspective long-term, and these kids present with other conditions down the road, such as depression or others because they're not getting good sleep. Right now, we're working through that issue. It's figuring out what is the right device for that for our study. Would this be a clearinghouse for that, or is this meant to be really, hey, you have X device you're going to bring to us or X vendor to bring to us to help work through the processes?
Yeah, so let me maybe not exactly like you're talking about, but just so, because it's a scaling issue, right? I mean, we probably won't be able to service everybody if we set up that infrastructure. Well, one of the things that we are immediately starting off with is to publish what are the priorities in this space? What are the things that we've seen that people are already struggling with or people are already researched on? So I think we are looking to figure a way to sort of communicate that. And perhaps this is where we want to set up a sort of a public-private way that we can work with folks like you to start understanding what those issues are, where we can provide, you know, preemptive sort of guidance rather than trying to handle it one-on-one basis, right? So it's probably not scalable in the point of the size of people. So we'd love to sort of hear these thoughts so we can actually set up a mechanism. So it's, you know, I don't want to say it's self-serve, but almost like preemptively people can go look up resources that are out there and work from there. And of course, after that, you still have issues that we need to work on. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is a scientific need. People are duplicating the same efforts, then we would want to make sure that's minimized.
Got it. And I'm going to go ahead and follow up with another question. This is on behalf of Clem McDonald. Wanted to know how engaged this group was with FHIR. I think what he's referring to there is, to what degree is that being baked in, considered, working through, and those types of standards and others.
Yeah, FHIR is something of great interest to me. And in fact, Steve and I worked on interoperability issues for a very long time, and want to continue to do that. Specifically, FHIR itself is not something FDA focuses on. We focus on standards, and we recognize those standards. And ask manufacturers of these technologies to implement those standards. And when they implemented, one caveat is we would ask less questions because we know it's a standardized way of doing whatever they're doing. And that's sort of how I see as we start moving forward. And we have recognized plenty of interoperability standards. And I think next round, we probably start to think about, like, what does that really mean if FDA recognized FHIR? Will it get implemented into lab services? Will it get implemented into in vitro diagnostic devices or even other devices that we regulate and ask people to sort of incorporate?
Got it. All right, we got about 1 minute left. I see Les Leonard really quick, sir, if you want to ask your question. Les, you there?
Got to hit the mute button. Yeah, thanks. Hey, what's your plans for developing evaluation paradigms or strategies for e-health? It's such a different field, plagued by many of the problems with telehealth, which has been extremely hard to evaluate the impact of. And the FDA has to be the leading source of these models and paradigms for how to prove that both the data are what people think it is, that it's getting transmitted to the right place, but more importantly, that it's actually making a difference in people's lives.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, there are some things that we don't regulate and there are things that we regulate. For example, we don't regulate, telemedicine, so to speak, where televisits are not regulated by FDA because it's really a communication sort of platform. But on the other hand, we do regulate, lab devices that are communicating with other hospital infrastructures as well. And there are some standards that we recognize for that. So there's definitely this jurisdiction boundary that we are bound with that we can't impose. What we can do instead of imposing is to recognize standards that may actually be helpful and give that signal that this is the way to sort of do things in the right way.
Excellent. But cool. Thank you very, very much. Excellent presentation. We have your email here. I'm sure I'm going to follow up with you personally, but I'm sure many people will.
Absolutely.
And we're a resource for you. So thank you for that. All right. Keeping to time, we are to Ms. Lauren Ritchie with the High Tech 2021 Final Work Plan.
Great. Thank you, Aaron. Not sure what happened with my camera there. Wanted to circle back on the committee's work plan for the year, especially for the public and those following along at home. We presented the draft work plan in November. We've since made a few tweaks, so just wanted to confirm that with you. And next slide. Great. So you all are familiar with the committee's priority target areas named in the Cures Act. In 2020, obviously, we added use of technologies that support public health and in response to COVID-related activities, then and moving forward. Next slide. So today, we'll just review the list of topics that are both confirmed and tentative for next year, we'll review what we've accomplished already, and then we'll talk a little bit about some additional opportunities for the committee beyond what's confirmed in the work plan. So next slide. Okay, so just so you know, a lot of thought went into this work plan, reviewed all the transcripts and the meeting summaries, looking at recommendations, not just from fiscal year 19, but actually prior to that, all of our other legislative requirements, and then, of course, conferring with our co-chairs. So next slide. So again, just to kind of recap briefly, hard to believe all that we've accomplished last calendar year, given the additional challenges, but everything from our COVID-19 hearing, completing the fiscal year 19 annual report, completing the ICAD final report, so quite a bit accomplished last year. We've got our fiscal year 20 report that's in progress, and of course, we'll be kicking off USCDI and any other COVID-related activities. And then on the next slide, we'll get into our planned activities for the year. So again, we made just a few tweaks to this overall work plan. Notably, we shifted the EHR Reporting Program Task Force to begin in March, and they will convene between March and April, hopefully wrapping up in April, well, no later than May. USCDI Task Force, that will begin here relatively shortly. The other adjustment that we made was moving the public health and HIE hearing to earlier in the year. So we'll be circling back and perhaps even reaching out to a couple of HITECH members to help inform the agenda for that hearing. A few items are still on the TBD list. We've got TEFCA that we know is coming down the pike. The ISP task force, I think we wanted to see how things kind of shake out a little bit with the USCDI and other standards-related activities. And then we have our EHR contract guide that we anticipate coming next year as well for the committee's review. Next slide. And then this captures other ideas that have bubbled up to the surface in terms of both HITECH suggestions as well as just industry priorities. Where time and opportunity presents itself, we will try to address these and fold these into the work plan at some point, if not at the very least, just to have an initial full committee discussion to figure out next steps as it relates to some of these activities listed here. So I know the committee has seen this particular work plan in our prior administrative call, but wanted to open it up to see if there are any additional thoughts or questions, or if there's anything that we should include in this list here for consideration in 2021, aside from what's confirmed in the work plan. And next slide. I think that's it. Yep. So if you want to go back to the next slide, any thoughts or questions or reactions? Of course, you know, some things may shift a tad bit, but for the most part, I think we've got our marching orders.
I think it's a great, great presentation, and hats off again to the ONC and phenomenal listening and leadership. As I think we've been echoing the entire meeting. So this is just a representation of that. I know personally, I'm looking forward to the privacy and security items, but that's just me because I'm a geek like that. But I think these are all great topics, and I look forward to it. Is there anybody with any questions? Please raise your hand or speak up. Okay. Well then, Denise, anything there before we move on to the next item? Maybe I'm mute.
That's our last presentation before public comment, I believe. And we did have some people who didn't get to ask their questions. And let's see, public comment is at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. So we have about 8 minutes. Is Alex still on? Is she still available? And if she is and Steve is still on, then we still had questions from Les and Cheryl on the CMS presentation.
Denise, I'm just confirming that Steve Posnack did have to drop it closer to 2, so he may not be on as well.
Oh, and I guess Alex dropped as well. Well, I would ask that Les and Cheryl, if you're able to type your comment in and submit it, that would, or a question, that would be great for Alex or Steve.
Okay, then do you want to open it up to any of the presentations and any questions folks may have had across the board, FDA or any of them? So I make sure folks get a chance.
It looks like Les has his hand up.
Hi, yes. Hi, I'm off mute. Good. Thank you. I just had the question for CMS as to what they were doing to test the standards that they're proposing in real-world environments, particularly at scale, to make sure they really have the impact on healthcare that they intend. I applaud everything that is in their proposals, but it seems to me that these standards are literally potentially revolutionary for healthcare and deserve the same sort of attention by the Innovation Center at CMS that some of its more modest proposals in payment have received, where there might be funding and a thorough evaluation of the impact on healthcare business processes and on ultimately the efficiency of healthcare. So what I'd like to hear is what the plans are, if any, for those types of large-scale pilots and whether they think the Innovation Center might be a good sponsor for those types of pilots.
Great questions. Great questions. I, too, also wonder that, to be honest with you. Other questions? It looks like Clem, looks like you have a question.
Yeah, I figured out how to get back on. So it's really to the FDA and maybe more generally than just the Innovation Center. But I think, you know, with the reality in today's world with fire, where you got the big IT companies jumping on board, Medicare jumping on board, insurance companies, healthcare industry, and FDA's not. And that almost seems like a disconnect, because FDA gets data, gets patients from the healthcare system, has to do post-release follow-up on the healthcare system. I mean, so there just seems to be sort of a mental block there, and if we could encourage that they would reduce that block and kind of incorporate and ingest, sort of like what Les just said, you know, the standards that are being adopted across the board in healthcare.
Sure. I think that's a good point. And my hope also is with this Innovation Center, we will lessen the number of vendors that claim FDA certification and not adopting modern standards on the provider side. So I hear that. Other comments or questions? Looks like Steve is still on. Do we want to go back to that question that we had earlier, Denise?
I think you mean Steve Posnack. I think they indicated he had the drop off.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. He is off. I'm sorry about that. Okay. Any other comments or questions? We've got about 4 minutes before public comment. Okay.
Is Dr. Rucker still on?
He may not be.
Him.
We have a all ONC meeting starting at 2, so that's why a few folks have started to drop.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because we wanted to, you know, open it to the floor if anybody else had any accolades or farewells to say. Apologize, we didn't do that at the beginning of the meeting. We got going on our agenda pretty quick there.
Yeah. Okay. So that, Denise, do you think we should go to public comment? Let's go ahead and get it going. Let's do it. Lauren?
Great. Then we'll ask the operator to open the public line, please.
Thank you. If you would like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. We will just pause for a brief moment to poll for comments. There are no comments at this time.
Wow. Okay.
They're shy. It's the first meeting of the year.
That's right.
Well, I guess we could yield time back to everybody for their day.
I do think that's a good idea. I do want to say thank you to everybody for listening, for attending. I see we had over 100 attendees and the high tech. Great job, as always, for the new attendees. Hopefully this wasn't too much throwing into the deep end of the pool, but you all did great, so welcome. We look forward to an upcoming fun year, and ONC, as always, hats off to you. I will close by saying thanks again to everybody, to the entire team, and to Dr. Rucker and the entire administration for their efforts. So, Denise?
And I echo that, and I want to thank everybody. I thought we had some really great dialogue and great input today. As we always do, this is a great group. And thank you, everyone, for your participation. And thank you for all the support, ONC and SL. And I look forward to talking with all of you next month.
That's right.
If not sooner. If not sooner.
And just as a reminder, if you haven't already sent me a note to let me know of your interest in remaining or being added to the USCDI task force, just please let me know. Otherwise, we'll see you all again on February 10th.
Sounds good. Have a good one. Be safe.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.